My name is Rick Dunning, and I am a geographer and geologist by trade. Live in Northfield, Minnesota, where I teach both of those subjects at college level. The title of today's session is Human Impacts on Climate, and it's kind of a general introduction to the ways that people can affect the world's climates. I have another session scheduled tomorrow that will focus specifically on the greenhouse effect. And today will be, as I say, a more general introduction. The first part of the session will be a little bit lecture-ish, just so that I can introduce a few general terms, and then look at the ways that people affect climate, and then finally some specific examples of people affecting the climate. When we look at day-to-day and week-to-week and even month-to-month changes in atmospheric conditions, we're talking about primarily weather. The short-term variations in temperature and cloud cover and precipitation are phenomena that together we call just weather. When we look at climate, then we're extending our time scale a little bit and looking at long-term average weather conditions for a specific place. What is the average temperature in Holden Village? What is the average precipitation? And not just what the average conditions are like, but what's the average amount of variability that you can expect within a season? How much does it change from winter to summer, or from the dry season to the wet season? How much change takes place? So climate concerns average conditions and average variability within a place. What is the typical weather patterns, for example? What's the typical summer weather, typical winter weather? And when climate is measured, it is usually measured on averages that span 20 to 30 years. Typical climatic measurements are 20 or 30 year average temperature or precipitation. And usually climatic measurements focus on some combination of temperature and precipitation, either as separate measurements or in some kind of combined measurement. Now, the first thing that you need to understand is that climate is not constant, has never been constant, that it changes on the longer term average of decades and centuries and even millennia. Now, there's some things that we need to understand about the nature of climate change. Climate changes on a variety of time scales simultaneously, which means that there are some long-term variations in climate, and there are also some short-term variations on climate. So that we could have a long-term cooling trend taking place over several hundred years, and at the same time, almost simultaneously and superimposed on that long-term cooling trend, we might have a short-term warming trend that covers several decades. So the climate could be cooling off and still experiencing short-term variability that seems like a warming trend. Climate change is not uniform over the whole Earth. Each place on the globe doesn't necessarily experience the same amount of climate change. And when we talk about past climate changes, we very seldom have specific measurements to work with. We have to use what we might call proxy data or indirect evidence of climate change in the past, because we don't have measurements of climate that go back very far. So we have to look at things like rock types and landforms, and we have to look at tree rings. It's another kind of indirect evidence. Looking at pollen that is preserved in the sediment of lakes and ponds and swamps can tell you how vegetation has changed and therefore be an indication of climate change. Looking at species of marine organisms that are buried in the sediment on the ocean floor is another kind of climate indicator. Looking at the chemistry of the shells of those marine organisms, and also looking at gas bubbles that are trapped in glaciers. By drilling a core down through a glacier that may have hundreds and thousands of years of ice preserved in it, scientists can actually measure the composition of the gas inside of air bubbles in the glacial ice, and therefore measure the composition of the ancient atmosphere. Now, there are several natural causes of climate change. One is continental drift, the fact that the continents are moving around on the continent. When North America moved far enough to the north, then that initiated what we today recognize as the Ice Age. Continental drift causes change not only on the continent as it moves, but it also affects global circulation of ocean currents and wind patterns, and that too will affect climate. There are natural climate changes caused by variations in the Earth's orbit. When the Earth goes around the Sun, sometimes the shape of its orbit changes, stretches out a little bit or shrinks in a little bit. Sometimes it gets more elongated, sometimes more circular. The Earth wobbles a little bit on its axis as it rotates around the Sun, or revolves around the Sun, and that too will alter how intense the sunlight is as it hits the surface of the Earth. Now, those kinds of changes take place over very long time scales. Continental drift is a very, very slow process in terms of the climate change it causes. The variations in the Earth's orbit happen over cycles of hundreds of thousands of years or tens of thousands of years. So that is responsible for long-term natural climate variations. We can get short-term natural climate variations because of changes in solar radiation intensity. I think many of you would be familiar with sunspots. Sometimes there are lots of sunspots on the surface of the Sun, sometimes very few. That affects the total output of solar radiation, at least slightly. Volcanic activity on the Earth's surface can affect climate because of the dust that's spewed out into the atmosphere, which can block out the sun's rays a little bit and cause some cooling. Shorter term climatic variations that take place over years or decades may have to do with changes in the atmospheric circulation patterns, specifically changes in the jet stream and the pattern of the jet stream as it moves across the continent. That too can cause variations in storminess and the amount of precipitation that we experience on the continent. Changes in the sea surface temperature also will affect the pattern of the jet stream and therefore affect, again, the way that storms develop over North America or over any continent. There are also some feedback mechanisms that operate within the climatic system. Feedback mechanisms that intensify or diminish a particular climatic change. Let me give you two examples. First, a positive feedback that accentuates a climatic change. Let's say that the initial climate change is toward a cooler temperature. Well, when the climate gets cooler, you expect snow cover to last longer on the surface at the higher latitudes. Well, if there's more snow on the Earth's surface, that snow surface will reflect sunlight rather than absorbing sunlight. And as the sunlight is reflected back into the atmosphere, that's going to cause more cooling, which will cause more snow, more reflection, more cooling, so that you have a cycle in which an initial small change in temperature is accentuated. A negative feedback will tend to negate any sort of climate change. And an example of that might be if we start with an initial warming condition. Well, as temperatures get warmer, there will be more evaporation of water from the ocean surface. And as more water gets into the atmosphere and condenses, you'll get more clouds. With more clouds in the atmosphere, that should block out solar radiation a little bit, which will cause a cooling trend, which will counteract the initial warming trend, so that it would cancel out. There are many kinds of climatic feedback mechanisms that we barely understand so far. Now, all of these natural climatic changes operate, as I say, on different time scales and with different intensity, and they all interact in some very complex ways. So that when we talk about climate change, we have to understand that natural climate change has been part of Earth history since the very beginning. Now, having said that, let's look more specifically at the ways that people might alter the climate of the Earth. And there are three general things that people could do to change the climate. One is by directly adding heat to the atmosphere. The second would be to alter the surface of the Earth, and therefore alter climate. And the third would be to alter the composition of the atmosphere, and thereby affect the way that the atmosphere behaves. So we've got three general ways we could affect the climate. Let's look at examples of each of those quickly. First would be the direct addition of heat. Generally speaking, this is not particularly important except in some urban areas. And in urban areas, you have such a concentration of people and specifically of combustion activities, both car engines and factories and heating or air conditioning systems, all in one place, that there is enough addition of heat in the atmosphere in an urban place that you can actually, the population could actually raise the temperature of the urban area. And climatologists will sometimes refer to this effect as the urban heat island, meaning that the city tends to be warmer than the surrounding countryside. Very common effect. Now, on that small scale, people can affect climate by adding heat. Part of the urban heat island is also because people change the surface of the Earth. Because in an urban area, you've got lots and lots of concrete. Concrete absorbs sunlight, heats up, and that causes the part of the urban heat island effect too. So it's not just the direct addition of heat. Our second way that people could change the climate is to alter the surface. And I've just mentioned concrete. Put enough concrete down, you're going to change the climate because of the added heating that's going on. Another way that people have changed climate by changing the surface of the Earth is a process that's known as desertification. It's going on the fringes of modern-day desert areas. Desertification means that the desert is getting bigger because of human land use on the semi-arid areas. Essentially, desertification results from overgrazing in a dry environment. And if you've got a lot of cattle or sheep grazing in a semi-arid environment, they're eating the vegetation, they're removing the natural vegetation. The barren landscape grows bigger, and the grass-covered landscape gets smaller. Now, that's simplistically the way that desertification works, is overgrazing. Climatically, when you remove the natural vegetation cover, you also change the possibilities for precipitation. The presence of natural vegetation in semi-arid regions actually contributes to the precipitation in that region. And when you take away the vegetation, you will diminish the precipitation in that area. In part because plants give off moisture as part of their respiration process. And that moisture goes back into the atmosphere, which can condense and fall again as rain. So you're reducing the amount of moisture getting into the atmosphere. Secondly, and this is perhaps more important, the natural vegetation through fungi and spores and mold that grows on the plants contributes little particles, little dust particles into the atmosphere. And those dust particles provide a nucleus for raindrops to form on. Any raindrop has to have something to condense around, or it will not form. And the dust particles coming off of the natural vegetation, because of the nature of the mold and fungi, provide very good nuclei for condensation. And so when you take away the vegetation, you take away an important source of condensation nuclei. You reduce the precipitation in the area, and that allows the desertification process to spread even more rapidly. So it's not just removing the vegetation, it's affecting the entire climatic pattern.
Better than just dust.
Yes.
Yeah. Have that organic stuff right on it.
It makes a better condensation nuclei. Now, another place in which people are concerned about altering the surface of the Earth on a large scale would be in areas of present-day rainforest, tropical rainforest. Again, a similar kind of effect that when you remove large areas of rainforest, you not only remove the vegetation, but you alter the possibilities for precipitation in that area. Much the same way that we just discussed with desertification. Again, altering the surface of the Earth affects climate only on a small scale, not global climatic change, but small-scale climatic change. But in certain areas, that climatic change can be quite significant. The third and most important way that people can affect climate is by literally altering the composition of the atmosphere, altering the gases that make up the atmosphere. Now, if we look briefly at what makes up our atmosphere, I'll often go to the board here, but let's look at this. The most important gas in the atmosphere by far is nitrogen. And nitrogen makes up about 78% of the atmosphere. The next most important gas is oxygen, which, of course, is what we need to breathe in order to stay alive. And that makes up about 21% of the atmosphere. The third most important gas is argon. And that makes up about 0.9%. The next most important gas is carbon dioxide, which makes up about 0.03% of the atmosphere. And along with carbon dioxide, the other important gases are ozone, of which in the total atmosphere there is just a trace, just a very, very minute part of a percent, and water vapor, which also, for the most part, is just a trace gas, although water vapor and ozone are both variable in their amounts, meaning that they can change through time. Now, although these gases make up almost all the atmosphere, nitrogen, oxygen, argon, they're not very important climatically. They're just there. Oxygen is important because we breathe it, but these gases have very little effect on what happens in terms of our climate. These gases at the bottom, which typically are there in variable amounts and just tiny, tiny bits of the total composition of the atmosphere, these are the gases that are most important climatically. They have the biggest effect on our day-to-day weather and long-term climatic conditions. And these gases, because they are there in such small amounts, are the gases that are most vulnerable to human activity, most vulnerable to changes. Now, let me list a few examples of specific ways people are changing the composition of the atmosphere, and then we'll just open up the rest of the time for discussing those various ways. Now, the first example would be changes in the ozone content in the atmosphere. Now, although ozone is a trace gas within the atmosphere, it tends to be concentrated in one particular layer right at the top of the lowest part of the atmosphere. So there is a layer of ozone around the lower atmosphere. So this tiny amount of ozone is concentrated in what we call the ozone layer. The ozone layer, which many of us have heard about, has gotten a lot of attention in the last few years in the popular media. The ozone layer is important because ozone as a gas absorbs ultraviolet radiation from the sun. The ultraviolet radiation is the most intense radiation that's coming from the sun. It is potentially the most damaging radiation. It is the radiation that causes sunburn. So when you're out, you get a sunburn, it's because your skin has been exposed to that ultraviolet radiation. Well, the ozone layer blocks out most of that ultraviolet radiation and therefore protects us from those harmful effects. Without the ozone layer, life as we know it could not exist on the Earth's surface. Now, because ozone is present in such small amounts, human pollution has begun to break down the ozone layer. Specifically, gases known as chlorofluorocarbons, or in the jargon, CFCs. And these CFCs seem like a perfect gas for a lot of human uses because they're very stable. They don't react with anything, at least not near the Earth's surface. So we use them in spray cans of paint and hairspray and deodorant because the gas doesn't mix with the stuff that it's propelling. It just acts as an inert gas and an inert propellant. We use it in refrigeration systems. We use it in the manufacture of styrofoam. Well, ozone, as I say, is inert until it gets up in the upper atmosphere. And then, fluorocarbons are inert until they get up in the upper atmosphere. And there, the CFCs react with sunlight. And in that reaction with the sunlight, they begin to break down the ozone molecules. And so it's the chemical reaction between the chlorofluorocarbons and the ozone that's diminishing the ozone layer. As the ozone layer is diminished, then more ultraviolet radiation will come through to the Earth's surface. There will be an increase in skin cancer and uncertain effects on crop production at this point. So that is one way that people are altering the chemistry of the atmosphere and potentially affecting our climate on the long-term scale. Another way that people are affecting the composition of the atmosphere is in the addition of carbon dioxide. You listed carbon dioxide as just a minute amount of the total atmosphere. People add carbon dioxide to the atmosphere through burning primarily coal and oil and natural gas. Carbon dioxide isn't really a pollutant in the classic sense. It doesn't smell, it doesn't cause health problems, and it's a natural byproduct of combustion. Every time you burn something, you give off carbon dioxide. It's just part of the process. But we burn so much coal and gas and oil in our industrial society that we have actually increased the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere since the Industrial Revolution. Now, carbon dioxide is important because it absorbs heat. The carbon dioxide gas actually absorbs heat in the atmosphere. Well, if you add more carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, it will absorb more heat. The atmosphere will get warmer. This is the effect that in the popular press is known as the greenhouse effect. By adding carbon dioxide, people are causing the atmosphere to warm up and potentially changing the entire climatic pattern of the Earth's surface. Those of us that live in Minnesota, warming doesn't always sound so bad, at least a little bit. But when you think about the places that would be most adversely affected by this global warming, it would be people living at lower latitudes, tropical climates today. And if you think about where many of the traditionally called third world countries are, they're in the lower latitudes. They're within 30 degrees either side of the equator. So those countries that today have the biggest problem feeding their people are the countries that would be most adversely affected by any increase in global warming. All the agricultural production would essentially shift northward. In some cases, that might be okay, perhaps, but the places that today we get a lot of our food from, Southern California, the desert southwest from irrigation agriculture, if the temperature warms up, those places will be also very much adversely affected. One of the big fears with this warming, of course, is that as the temperature increases, it may cause the melting of glaciers on Greenland and Antarctica. And as those glaciers melt, then sea level will rise. And we have a lot of cities that are located right at sea level. And if sea level goes up, then many of those cities will find themselves at least partially underwater. And again, some of the largest third world cities are coastal cities. And again, places that would be very much susceptible to those kinds of effects. Now, when the carbon dioxide problem is exacerbated by what we mentioned earlier with deforestation. Because when you cut down trees, remember that trees take in carbon dioxide and give off oxygen. If there are fewer trees, there are fewer plants available to absorb that excess carbon dioxide. So deforestation not only changes the climate in a local area, but also contributes to the global warming associated with this greenhouse effect. Another problem that is related to the burning of fossil fuels is the problem of acid rain, a third example of altering the composition of the atmosphere. Particularly the burning of coal gives off sulfur compounds and nitrogen compounds, which in the atmosphere mix with rain to create weak acids, sulfuric acid and nitrous acid. Those acid raindrops fall to the earth, and I think you can guess what the effect of acid on living things would be. Harmful for vegetation, harmful for any aquatic organisms, and in areas that are particularly susceptible to acid precipitation, such as Scandinavia or New England, where the soil is thin, rocky, there are a lot of shallow lakes there, those areas have been particularly devastated. In parts of the Midwest, the effects are less because we have a lot of soil. And bedrock that can buffer the effects of acid rain. It still tends to harm the vegetation, but it's had less effect on some of the lakes and streams in the Midwest. A fourth example of altering the composition of the atmosphere has to do with the production of aerosols, dust, smoke, and ash getting up into the atmosphere. Aerosols in general refer to tiny particles, either solid particles or liquid particles, that are released into the atmosphere primarily as a result of industrial processes. Smoke is the best example. Now, the effect of aerosols is a little bit controversial. Some people say that aerosols, these dust particles, will cause cooling because they'll block out sunlight. Some people say that the aerosols will cause warming because the dust particles will absorb heat, and that will contribute to the greenhouse effect. Both of those things happen depending on what kind of particle it is. Dust tends to cause cooling. Ash and soot tends to cause warming. It also depends on whether the material is high in the atmosphere or low in the atmosphere, where it's released as a pollutant. So the aerosols can have variable effects. Now, I could go on with some other examples. I think probably it's more valuable to spend some time just kind of talking amongst ourselves. Let me say a couple of things to kind of pull these general comments together. One is that, remember that climate refers to long-term average conditions, so that it can be a long time before we notice any changes from these effects of human activity. It takes a long time before there's any noticeable warming in the atmosphere if you're working with 30-year average temperature measurements. Now, the problem is it makes it more difficult to convince people to do something about the problems because it takes a longer time to prove that they're actually having an effect on the atmosphere. And that continues to be one of the biggest battles, is how long do we have to wait to demonstrate that these effects are actually taking place? The measurements that are coming in from the 1980s suggest yes, temperatures are getting warmer in the last couple of decades, and that is starting to elicit some action from the powers that be. Remember, if it takes a long time to see the effects of these alterations on climate, it's also going to take a long time to correct them. And so there is no instant cure for the problem of global warming, or the problem of acid rain, or the problem of ozone depletion. These are problems that are very slow to develop. They're also going to be problems that will be very slow or take a long time to cure. And that makes the need for fast action even more important. Now, having said all of that, why don't we just open it up for questions and talk about things that are on your mind, yeah, Rick?
Of the CFCs that you talked about, Rick, is there any general field that you can... You mentioned the refrigeration industry, you mentioned spray cans and that. Do you have any breakdown as to which ones of those contribute the most, or any feel for that?
Well, anymore, the big contributors seem to be in the refrigerants and the styrofoams, particularly. Styrofoam has been the biggest one. Most of the spray cans have pretty much removed CFCs, at least in the United States. That's not true globally, but the U.S. has cut back quite a bit on CFC use, particularly as refrigerants or as spray propellants. But I think, as I say, the styrofoam and the refrigerants still remain a big problem.
And that, you know, often we will not do something in this country, but we export it. Are we exporting the spray? I mean,
We're certainly exporting those technologies. We aren't specifically exporting spray cans that have CFCs in them. But many countries are using those kinds of spray cans because, or those technologies, because that's what we provided for them.
Is there a difference in the cost of the other propellants rather than the...
My impression is not. I think it was just that the CFCs were so convenient and worked so well. But there are substitutes available largely for all of the uses of CFCs anymore. It's just getting people to use those substitutes.
Has there been any studies about the effects of an area of deforestation in the way of either clear cutting in the Northwest or for farmland in the rainforest, as to the amount of carbon dioxide those trees take, the amount of oxygen they produce, and the cooling effect they have? Has anyone really studied that so we know empirically what's going on, instead of just hearing shouts from people?
No. The studies have been done. The only numbers that I know are that you can figure that an average tree absorbs about 50 pounds of carbon dioxide per year. So to contrast that with some other data, when you burn 1 gallon of gas, you give off about 20 pounds of carbon dioxide. So it takes one tree for every two gallons of gas you use.
But the tree was a whole year, right?
Yeah. So.
So we need a lot of forest.
Need a lot of forest.
Does it have to be, I mean, how does the carbon dioxide mix in the atmosphere? Is it down low and does it spread around?
No, it's fairly evenly spread out. The other way that carbon dioxide is removed from the atmosphere is into the oceans, primarily by plankton, macroscopic plants near the surface of the ocean. But a lot of carbon dioxide is absorbed into the ocean, settles to the bottom, and forms sedimentary rock. Limestone is carbon that was removed from the atmosphere and now is in rock form rather than gas form.
But I guess I was wondering, let me finish this. If we have a lot of forest down in, you know, South America or whatever, and the factories up here putting out the carbon dioxide, do those forests do any good for this carbon dioxide, or does it just go on up and never gets recovered by trees?
At least a little bit, yeah.
Some does.
Yeah, sure.
It's my understanding the ozone depletion is concentrated in the Antarctica area. Why is that so?
There seems to be two holes that have developed in the ozone layer, one over the South Pole and one near the North Pole. And there's still some uncertainty about why that is. It may be because of the temperature conditions in that part of the atmosphere, or it may have something to do with the Earth's magnetic field and the orientation of the North and South magnetic poles. And it's difficult to know whether those holes are naturally occurring in that part of the atmosphere because they've just recently been discovered, or whether those holes have just developed in recent time. So we're uncertain about, you know, how those holes fit into the whole scheme of ozone depletion. But measurements of the total ozone in the ozone layer, or at least in different places around the atmosphere, suggest that ozone has been decreasing in other places, not just over the poles.
I think it's something we talked about on your hike. The articles that I have read about this have indicated that one thing is that if you inject more carbon dioxide into a greenhouse, which is something they do to stimulate growth, the plants will grow faster. So that it's a natural balance that the Earth is trying to keep up, that with more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, it actually increases plant growth. If we wouldn't keep taking out our forests, it might start to counteract that.
It's quite possible.
But as we remove the forest, you know that. But it is something that, you know, the Earth is trying to keep up.
Again, we're talking about feedback mechanisms within the climatic system, and there would be that tendency to counteract the increased carbon dioxide by increased plant growth. But whether that will actually happen in the way that we affect the ecological system is another question.
Do we know of a way to replenish the ozone? Is there any reaction that does that?
Well, we produce a lot of ozone. Ozone is a major pollutant in urban areas coming from automobile exhaust. And you will sometimes hear in big cities of ozone alerts because it acts as an irritant in your eyes, and it gets in your lungs and kind of... It can be dangerous, particularly for people that have respiratory problems originally. But there's no way to get the ozone from on the ground level up into the high atmosphere. The ozone apparently is produced by natural reactions in the upper atmosphere over on a very slow process, perhaps part related to lightning and the effects of lightning. And in part the reaction of oxygen and sunlight in the upper atmosphere. But no way for people to get ozone up there. Another problem with the CFCs, the chlorofluorocarbons, is that not only do they affect the ozone layer, but the CFCs themselves also absorb heat like carbon dioxide. And in effect, the CFCs are much more effective at absorbing heat, so they add to that global warming problem.
Has there been any conjecture or theories as to what point a runaway effect would occur?
No. No one has mentioned that yet. The key emphasis among the scientific community now seems to be just to slow down the effects. Even just that much would help. If we could slow down the rate at which the pollution is taking place and the rate at which the warming is taking place, that would be a major step. And to do that, we would have to cut our energy use in half.
And that can't be done without changing lifestyles.
No.
And lifestyles cannot be done, cannot be changed unless there are alarmists. And that, I guess that's why I get upset with the scientific community, because there are those who are the alarmists, but there are others who are always, who are cautious, always saying, now wait a minute, we aren't, you know. No. I guess I feel like I'd be happier if they were all alarmists, so we would start moving on it.
No.
What's the worst of the evils here? A lot of us, including us, use wood as a primary heating source in our residences. Wood, oil, natural gas, is what should we be using at this point to minimize the impact?
Probably the cleanest fuel at this point in terms of carbon dioxide is natural gas. That gives off the least amount of carbon dioxide as it's burned. The biggest gains we're going to get are in the realm of conservation, of more efficient engines and more efficient heating systems, better insulation in homes. In effect, we're talking about another energy crisis. Remember back in the 70s, 74 and 79, back in those years, then it was an oil shortage that was causing the need for conservation and fuel efficiency. Now it's the atmosphere that's providing the limits. And so we need to think more carefully about how do you conserve energy and how do you make cars more efficient, how do you use less, more efficient light bulbs, that type of thing. So those are the practical things that we can do right away, is to cut back on carbon dioxide emissions. One figure that I read suggests that if you figure about 5 billion people in the world, we're each allowed 2 tons of carbon dioxide per year. That's how much we can each emit and bring about some stability to this warming trend. So again, if you think in terms of what does that mean, 20 pounds per gallon of gas, each kilowatt of electricity that you burn is responsible for 2 pounds of carbon dioxide, so that you can literally calculate about how much carbon dioxide you contribute every year. And when you get to 2 tons, you have to stop. The problem comes, of course, in if we start talking about cutbacks in energy use, what does that do for developing countries who are trying to industrialize and develop at the same time? We're saying, no, we all should be cutting back now. And who should bear the burden of these cutbacks? Do we need to cut back more so that they have the chance to expand their economies still? And so those are going to be some very, very hard questions that we have to deal with in the next couple of decades. And that when you talk about climate, you're talking about global problems that affect the whole world, and problems that will require global cooperation. And I think we know from experience how hard global cooperation is to achieve.
What does nuclear energy contribute?
Essentially nothing in terms of carbon dioxide.
Their waste.
It's waste heat.
It's the radiation hazard that still is the problem with nuclear. Some people have suggested that, well, does this mean we go back to nuclear after all the cutbacks? And I think probably not, because at the expense of nuclear power. If you think about how much electricity you get out of a nuclear plant for the amount of money you invest in it, we'd achieve a whole lot more through conservation and more efficient technologies than we would through an extensive nuclear program. And I think the safety factor would make that even more important.
Do you think this will give impetus to starting up development of wind and solar energy again?
I think it's time for those
technologies. It was rolling. Yeah. It was rolling until about 8 years ago. Yeah.
when oil was plentiful again, and Reagan was elected.
Yeah, now cheap oil has really undermined the alternative technologies, and I think it's time to
develop
look
those.
Back at them more carefully. Particularly solar electric cells, I think, as that technology improves, that will be a more important source of electricity.
And has there continued to be research in those fields so that there's...
Oh, yes. The solar electric cells have been improving all along.
How would you assess the public awareness of these problems, say, in the United States, Western Europe, Eastern Europe?
Well, I think in the U.S. and Western Europe, I think the awareness is certainly at a decade high right now. I think after last summer's drought, these kinds of problems received much more attention than ever before, probably since the late 60s in the environmental movement. At this point, awareness is higher than it has been in well over a decade or two. But I'm not sure it's quite enough yet. I'm sure it's not enough yet, but...
By enough, you mean to translate into political action?
To political and personal action.
And personal.
Personal action as well.
Yeah, because we're buying bigger cars.
Yeah.
I mean, when you read the statistics on cars, we've gone back to big cars in the U.S.
Well, how about in Eastern Europe? Are they at least aware of the problem?
It's hard to assess that, but...
Do they participate in international conferences that come meet to discuss these problems?
My impression is not to any great extent. And the Soviet bloc countries are very energy intensive in their industrial development right now. And they need to do something as much as we do. China is in a big industrialization program right now, and all their industrialization is based on coal, burning coal as their source of energy. And that's not an encouraging prospect.
Does the use of solar for a nation or a region have a lot to do, I mean, the potential, does it really have a lot to do with what their weather's like?
Oh, yes.
It really does. So there would be some areas of the world that's not really a good option.
Less possible, yeah.
But a lot that they
would. My profession, I'm involved with the refrigeration industry, and I know there's an awareness there. There's been a lot of articles written, a lot of research done in the last year or two, and I think it's driven from the fact that the government has mandated that thou shall be phasing out these CFCs. And at least in that industry, they're trying to develop other refrigerants which are less harmful, and that can be phased in. So at least in that industry, I think there's a very good awareness at this point, and there's actually action being taken.
What about if someone were to develop? How do you say it? Cold water
vision? Yeah.
If that were to become a reality, wouldn't that be able to change everything, barring economics?
Theoretically.
Money and all the rest.
I'm not sure we can afford at this point to sit around and wait for it.
No, I know.
But theoretically, it could. But there are plenty of scientists who are as convinced it won't work as there are that are convinced it will work. at this point, you know.
Well, you just said we can't afford to wait. Should I read into that, that you personally think we are in a crisis state?
I think we need to act now to avoid being irretrievably into that crisis state, yes. I think we need to act seriously to cut back on our carbon dioxide emissions and our pollutants.
And I get the impression from political meetings that I go to that political issues have dropped way down in what the politicians perceive as the public concern.
Well, if that's the case, then education is needed to
bring it
back up where it belongs.
I was speaking to someone who'd been back to Washington and D.C. and had been talking to some politicians back there, and it was really enlightening. He said that, like the acid rain, you know, they want to work on cleaning up the industry, and they want to work on, you know, helping industry, you know, put out less pollutants. He says what they need to do and what they know they need to do, but they're afraid to, is tell people they can't drive as much, they shouldn't drive as much. But they don't want to tell people to alter their lifestyle, so it's easier to look like you're busy over here doing something when you're really not. And so, you know, they're afraid to... They don't want people to, you know, they don't want to drop a bomb on somebody and say, hey, you got to change your lifestyle.
Oh, when you think at this point about how completely geared our economy is to energy consumption, and if you think about how fragile that economy is in terms of how little it takes to initiate a recession, and that was the ultimate effect of the last energy crisis was a global recession. And if we talk about cutbacks in that industrial system, then there are some economic problems that we're going to have to deal with as well. And those are hard. Like I say, the problems just get harder. The decisions and choices just get harder from this point on.
But would improvements in transportation make a major contribution? I mean, that would not be as disruptive to the economy as a lot of other necessary changes would be.
And mass transportation.
And there should be some development of employment in those alternative energy technologies as well.
Yeah.
I think conservation and personal cutbacks that people can do right away is the best first step in slowing the energy use.
What's happening with styrofoam across the country right now? I know in Portland they're outlawing it.
State of Oregon is, and there are other,
I think Spokane, or at least someplace in Western Washington is doing that. And I just wondered what's happening throughout the country.
My impression is that the biggest effort at this point is looking at recycling technologies for styrofoam.
And that won't do anything,
Which is
you still manufacture it. Is
you're still using it,
The manufacturing process?
Well, that's to avoid the fill up the landfills.
Landfills.
You know, get rid of that particular problem, but it's not dealing with the atmosphere, does it?
Not so much, although... Again, recycling it will produce less pollution than making it from scratch.
Does the pollution come from when it's like sitting in the landfills and coming out, or is it in the process of making it?
Both.
I mean, actually, the slow decomposition of styrofoam releases whatever it is.
Which is that when the styrofoam is like decomposing or not decomposing or whatever. There, I was listening to someone else saying that when the styrofoam is sitting there in the landfill, that then slowly these come out of it and enter into the atmosphere, and that was, but I don't remember what, if that was CFC or if that was...
Should be CFCs.
Mm-hmm. And then when it's burned, of course, that's when it goes up much more.
Yeah, plus other noxious gases.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
It's
Well, I thank you all for your kind attention. We need to bring this to a close in order to get ready for the picnic. But
thank you.
Tomorrow, the greenhouse effect, right?
Tomorrow, we'll look more carefully at the greenhouse effect.